It's showtime.
Go head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go, off and running on this, the 29th day of August 2023. I stand amazed, actually I'm sitting, that, well, August is mostly gone. We got two more days of August. And, well, here we are. An entire blessed summer has blown on by. Got about, what, 22 days left of summer now? Hi, I'm Robin. Just things that I sit around musing on. Sorry, can't help it. I'm just already planning on freezing to death. Not to death, but you know what I mean. I love autumn. Oh, the colors. Meh. Right, Darlene? Right. So, this is the horn. HeadOn.live is where you'll find us on the interweb tubes. That's where you go if you'd like to be part of the merry, wacky, zany, real-time, madcap, multimedia extravaganza that is the Horn chat room in the 3 hours in which this program is live, Monday through Friday, 5 to 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 2 to 5 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time, all time zones in between and the Great Globe Round, and whatever time it is when you're listening to the podcast. If you're listening live, though, pop on by the aforementioned Merry Wacky Zany, and you'll be greeted by the early arrivers, Irish Dave and Squeaky and Theo. Hey, y'all. And capably moderated by longtime inveterate, well, no, by Horn Chief. Sometimes I get, this stuff gets embedded in your brain after a while. Sometimes, you'll be capably moderated. Actually, he is longtime and inveterate and indefatigable. But he's Horn Chief Mathematician, Chief Agronomist, and Bud Trimmer Emeritus, Roger in Oregon, who notes he came home from 3 days of camping and found these on the vine, 28 and a half pounds of tomatoes canned. That's why he's the Horn's Chief Agronomist, y'all. Oh, those canned tomatoes are going to be so good come February. Yeah, oh, that's going to be wonderful. Congratulations, Roger. You'll be greeted by the early arrivers. Come on by if you've never tried it before, if you're new to the program, what have you. And if you are a listener to the podcast, well, whether it be at Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or Podbean or Spotify or iHeartRadio or TuneIn or wherever, please like and subscribe to the program. Leave a comment for the lonely, lonely, lonely algorithms. It helps the algorithm figure out that, hey, she's not just howling into the void. People actually listen to this. And maybe even tell your friends and neighbors. I beg and I plead and I say, please tell your friends and neighbors, because we want to expand this conversation, especially with the political year rapidly approaching. What am I talking about? Rapidly approaching. It's here. We've already had one Republican pageant. There's going to be another one out at what? Old 666 himself, Ronald Wilson Reagan's tacky ass library. I mean, I guess it's just on, right? Yeah. And every program here at the Horn begins with gratitude. This program is no different. So let me start by thanking a kind internet anonymous friend who met Ralph's challenge yesterday so as to keep yesterday from being a total goose egg. Thank you so much, kind internet anonymous friend. Ralph's challenge has been met. And, well, what does that mean for us? It means that we are at $1,940 to go to be fully funded up to this, the 29th day of August. We have no subscribers on the 29th. We have none on the 30th. We have none on the 31st. So with that in mind, I want to go ahead and do our thank yous for our Patreon subscribers. And by the way, my apologies over at Patreon. I very sincerely do need to I need to update a certain photograph at Patreon. As quick as I figure out how to do that, I will. Ah! I hate it when I see that. So let's say thank you to our Patreon subscribers. Thank you very kindly to Theo out in Oregon. Thank you, Theo. And thank you to Randy Radar. And thank you to Christopher. And thank you to Janice and David. David in Oregon. Thank you, Eve. Thank you, Jake in Ohio. Thank you, Nancy. Thank you, Bernadette. Up there in Humboldt. Thank you to Michael of the Guffins. Thank you to Jeff in Slow. Thank you, Kay. Thank you, Andrea. Thank you to James and to Aaron. And thank you, Annette. Not Annette here, Annette. Yes, different Annette. Thank you to Joanne. Thank you, Lori. Thank you to Vernon in San Diego. Thank you to Kat in Ohio. Thank you, Brendan. Thank you, KW. Thank you, Irwin in Montana. Thank you, Barb. Thank you, Horst in Taiwan. Thank you, Robin. Another Robin with a Y. Thank you, Terrace, and thank you to Brother Deacon Asa, and thank you to Jeremy. Thank you also very much for being partial sponsors of the program and helping us to survive from month to month. We have a little over one day's worth of broadcasting in terms of Patreon subscribers. If you'd like to be a Patreon subscriber, it's very easy. All you have to do is go to headon.live and click on Contribute, and the Patreon link is right there. For that matter, if you'd like to help out via the U.S. Postal Service, the mailing address is also at the Contribute tab. The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, W-V, 25801. So thank you. Thank you one and all for keeping liberal, progressive, non-capitalist, non-profit-driven, independent media on the air for almost 20 years, and that blows my mind. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Now, it is Titanic Tuesday. Let me check in with some email real quick. Lee tells me the autumnal equinox will arrive at 2:49 a.m. on Saturday, September the 23rd. Lee says, feel free to sleep past it. Lee looking skyward in New York City. You can see the sky in New York? Dang, I didn't know that. So, yeah, we got Yeah, call it 22, 23, 24 days of summer left. Not even one full month. Oh, if girl's ever going to get to the lake, she better get busy. Thank you, Lee. No worries, Steve, in New York. Thank you. I'm just checking a couple of that. Okie doke. So, Titanic Tuesday is named, of course, you may recall, for something that happened 20 years ago in America's fifth smallest radio market, in Beckley, West Virginia, when the morning monotone went on air and answered a question from one of his mouth-walking, knuckle-breathing followers.
Who said, Steve, how come it is that there is seashells in the rocks in West Virginia? I done seen them down in the coal mine. We ain't nowhere near the beach.
To which he replied, and he has, of course, gone to the great beyond and Nil Nisi Bonum and all of that, but in one of the most stunning monotones of all time, and he said,
Well, caller, that's because of the movement of the Titanic plates.
Giving Titanic Tuesday its name. Titanic Tuesday. In which, despite everything else, there's still no word on the whereabouts of the Titanic lemon zester. It may be buried underneath the libertarian death thermos, for all we know. That adds a little bit to the whole Titanic Tuesday mythology. But just by way of getting us started on things that are stupid and right-wing, Moms for Liberty, sit, Liberty, sit, has officially opened their West Virginia chapter. Yeah, I saw that news last night and I greeted it like a bum tooth. No word yet on whether Moms for Liberty, sit, Liberty, sit, in the West Virginia chapter has gotten around to approvingly quoting Adolf Hitler yet, but, well, give them a minute. So that tax-exempt grift will be a thorn in our side for some time to come. Meh. And in terms of Titanic intellect, been a while since we've mentioned this guy. David Frum. Remember David Frum? The Atlantic, and by extension, the Daily Caller, refer to him merely as the author of Trumpocracy, the Corruption of the American Republic. But David Frum is one of the people responsible, way, 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 way back in 2002, for coining the phrase, the axle of evil.
Yeah, we're going to take on the axle of evil.
Remember that? Remember Dim Leader feeling all butch and macho? And he's,
you got your axle of evil. And that would be your Iraq and your Iran and your North Korea. And the Iraq, they tried to kill my daddy. Fuck Saddam. We're going to take him out.
And, you know, a million innocent Iraqis wound up dying because of George W. Bush and Darth Cheney and that guy who licked his comb and Donald Rumsfeld and Mr. Scooter. A million dead. And that's not counting the lives that he wasted
in his war of choice the American lives and the Allied lives that he wasted in attacking a country that did not lift a finger at us. No. Well, David Frum published today at The Atlantic an argument against Section 3 of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States, which law professors, far more intelligent than David Frum, have pointed out is a self-executing constitutional provision that prevents people who participate in insurrections from running for office. David Frum, clutching his pearls and wringing his hands, said, "The project to disqualify Trump from running for president is misguided and dangerous. It won't work. If it somehow could work, it would create problems worse than even than Americans already face. The least of these problems is the legal one. Whether Trump's scheme to seize the presidency by fraud, then violence, amounts to a rebellion or an insurrection under the amendment." There will be a lot of disagreement on that point, enough to generate litigation. But let's suppose that the excluders win in court or that the courts abdicate altogether, kicking the dispute back to the elected branches of government as a political matter. Well, the use of the section to debar candidates would not stop at Trump. It would become dangerously a convenient tool for partisan politics. Only if you participate in an insurrection, David. Jesus, these people. I mean, granted, it might be used to, say, try to keep about 150 maggots in the House of Representatives and 5 or 6 in the Senate off the ballot, but explain to me how that's a bad thing. Oh, but David has an illustrative point. Because in the world of people like David Frum, there's always some whataboutism to be had. What about Ilhan Omar? She compared Al-Qaeda with the U.S. military. David Frum suggesting, well, she could be charged with giving aid and comfort to the enemy. And then suggesting that the two young black lawmakers in Tennessee, more on them in a minute, could be forever banned from the Tennessee State House because they led a rebellion. Jesus, the white fragility. From trying to still maintain his never Trump street cred, said,
"In an ideal world, Trump's fellow Republicans would handle this matter by repudiating his crimes and rejecting his candidacy for their presidential nomination, failing that. And it certainly seems as if that hope is failing. Opponents of Trump must dig deep and beat him at the polls one more time. There is no cheat code to win this game.
I love it. I love it when hand-wringing pearl clutchers refer to an amendment, a clause in an amendment to the Constitution of the United States that's central to citizenship itself as a cheat code. The Atlantic publishes some great stuff. Hint, this ain't one of them. This is pretty easy, actually. Don't gin up an insurrection. Never Trump David Frum, apparently, coming up on 3 years post the January 6th terrorist attack on the Capitol of the United States, still hasn't decided whether that was an insurrection. Now, I'm sure the great legal minds of the Horn Family Community Congregation could maybe do an elemental analysis of January 6th, 2021, and reach some kind of consensus. Let's see. He called for a mob to come to Washington, D.C. planned the mob's activities with his cohorts and minions for weeks on end. On the day that the mob arrived, January 6, 2021, which just happened to be the same day as the certification of the 2020 election that would guarantee that Nitwit Nero had to leave office, he addressed that mob, inflamed that mob. That mob had arrived with guns and knives and broom handles and swords and assegais and straight razors and body armor and Confederate flags and buffalo head helmets. I mean, whipped them into a frenzy and sent them off toward the capital of the United States, where they then attacked the said capital of the United States, overran it, shit on the floors, wiped it on the walls, stole stuff, things as prosaic as a lectern, and behaved generally like vandals having breached the walls of Rome. Oh, she's going off to Rome, isn't she? No, don't worry. But, yeah, Clause 3 of the 14th Amendment is a cheat code. Because David Frum is hip, and he knows how to talk gamer talk. Yes. Oh, it is better to be silent and thought a fool than to open one's mouth and remove all doubt. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Clemens. Pay attention, David. I said more on the Tennessee 3. Well, here we are. Yesterday, during a floor session in Nash Vegas, the maggot majority in the House of Representatives decided that Representative Justin Jones shall not speak nor debate on bills for the remainder of the entire day, because we done passed laws in this here body to punish uppity black folk. There's a special session going on in Tennessee over the bills that Republican Governor Bill Lee called in order to deal with Tennistan's incredibly loose and, dare I say, grossly, willfully, wantonly negligent and cavalier position on firearms, you know, as dictated to Tennessee Republicans by the National Ruble Association, the most powerful and well-funded domestic terror organization in the United States. The House and the Senate cannot agree in Tennessee on how to proceed. The Associated Press report says that the Tennessee House and Senate are locked in an icy standoff. Honey, it's Nashville, Tennessee in August. There ain't nothing icy in that entire city. Even the icy machines are busted. Locked in an icy standoff over what to pass as families close to the shooting at Covenant Christian School have increasingly voiced their frustrations with the legislative process. At one point in time, the Tennessee maggots sent the state troopers into the gallery to remove peaceful citizens therefrom who were simply holding signs, and then banned signs. First Amendment much, Tennessee maggots? And so the maggots aren't taking up any meaningful gun control changes. old Bill Lee there, the maggot governor, all in the world he wants to do is have a red flag law in Tennessee to keep people who ought not be owning AR-15s from owning AR-15s if they've been in some wise adjudicated not all home, not all the bulbs in the chandelier burning brightly, you know? And so Justin Jones stood up to speak, and at the time he had been critiquing bullshit legislation that so far has proven not to work. Hi, Uvalde! That would put more cops in schools, you know, to run away. And went and began going about the business of saying, you know, here's some things that we actually need in schools. At which point, the Speaker of the Tennessee House, Cameron Sexton, said, I'm a warning the young Negro not to stray from the topic. I don't know, somehow that seems pertinent, things that schools need besides cops in classrooms. Here's what he got silenced for, Justin Jones. What our schools need are mental health professionals. We need funding for mental health, for counselors. We need to pay our teachers better. We don't need more police in our schools. Cameron Sexton said, Oh, I hereby declare the young Negro is out of order, and we will have a vote on whether to make him be quiet for the rest of the day. Can't have him whooped or nothing. They done taken all the good stuff away from us. Democrats who were understandably pissed began telling their maggot colleagues, y'all don't want to do this. But 70 maggots said, that young Negro must be learn to be quiet and know his place and not be so uppity. And so the rest of the Democratic caucus, white and black alike, said, okay, you're throwing him out, we'll just walk out with him. And the crowd did begin to get a little cranky because they'd begun to yell at Cameron Sexton, fascist! Racist! And Cameron sent the state troopers into the gallery to get rid of the public so they couldn't watch the maggots doing their filthy business. And Cameron Sexton, speaking to reporters later, said, now looky here, house rules are house rules. We done voted on it. Might not like the rules, but the rules is what they are. Yeah, there's only one problem. It's not like that's a 200-year-old rule. That's a rule that they put in place after the last time Justin Jones dared to speak up and speak truth to power. Yeah, you might want to think of it as the uppity Negro rule. And the folks in the gallery just got madder and madder, yelling, vote them out. Whose house? Our house. Went on for several minutes. And Cameron Sexton, who apparently wants to rule with an iron fist, said to Justin Jones, I'm warning you, you're near impugning the reputation of representing Gino Bolzo. No, really, Bolzo. By calling his bills reprehensible, asinine, and insulting. Well, decide for yourself. G. Gino Bolzo. Oh, really? It wanted a bill to let private schools with pre-K classes to, wait for it, allow guns on campus. Son of a... You know what we need? More guns. Now, Bolzo, meanwhile, had said of Justin Jones, he continually misrepresents facts to the public, which is within the purview of the new uppityness law rule in the House, but, well, Gino Bolzo's nice and white, so it didn't get used on him. He also went so far as to say Justin Jones makes outrageous statements. And nobody moved to silence him for that either, even though he was impugning the character of Justin Jones. Jones went on and said, you know, we here should stop trying to put more guns to start a gunfight in our schools that would not protect our children. What is one little Glock against an AR-15? He's impugning the character of the fine, fine Glock Arms Manufacturing Corporation, founded in Austria, but now making guns right here in America. It was the Glock comment that got him declared out of order. I don't know about y'all, but I'm real proud of the folks showing up there in the Tennessee legislature, the regular citizens, who are, in all the photos I've seen, about 10 to 1 women and mamas. They hold signs, Covenant Mom for Firearm Safety, Creating Brighter Tomorrows Together. They wear t-shirts that say, get used to seeing these faces, Covenant Families Action Fund. And of course, in the wake of the Jacksonville slaughter of this past weekend, some maggot who's name was really not worth committing to one of my brain cells, said, we're talking about the manifesto that this fine young Nazi left, and yet we still ain't seen the manifesto left by that transgender what done shot up the Covenant school. That's true. We have not seen the manifesto of the Covenant school murderer. But we also don't know whether that individual was trans or non-binary or, well, I mean, non-binary falls under trans, but you get my point. And we still don't, we don't know what was going on that motivated that individual. But we do know that Covenant School has had a pervy Christian sexual abuse problem. Remember, the guy who co-wrote Mike Huckabee's campaign bio with him? Well, he was at Covenant School. And people keep saying, y'all, he's a perv. I am not a pervert. I am a Christian. Those things are not mutually exclusive, Bubba. And then it turned out he was a perv. Oops. But you begin to get a sense that things are changing in this country when the locus of hell being raised by firearms reform advocates is Tenistan. These maggot mongrels always overreach. And they may finally reach too far. One may hope. But I'm sure that the National Rural Association is spreading money around as quickly as they possibly can in the Tenistan legislature to make sure that Tennessee schools remain a free fire zone. Yes, it was the Axis of Evil, Matt, in San Francisco. I've always called it the Axel of Evil because that sounds even dumber. Hi, Matt. The calm liquor, Lee in New York reminds us, was Paul Wolfowitz. That table, referring to the Titanic table, Steve in New York says, after 20 years, I can't even begin to think how large the Titanic table with all those Titanic tools on it is. It probably ran the length of the entire ship at this point. And Steve adds, as to David Frum, I had to recheck my calendar to make sure it isn't April 1st. Oh, it's... There's never a day when some hand-wringing, pearl-clutching apologist for... Because, see, they're never Trump Republicans, but they're still Republicans. They just want Trump to go away so they can go back to having Republicans who don't say the quiet part out loud and go about doing their filthy business hurting America. Oh, and as to Iraq, Steve says that. Don't forget the 5 million-plus internal and external refugees. By the way, fuck David Frum. And anytime I say New York City, somebody is bound to write New York City. Thank you. And Emilio feeling musical this afternoon. Roam if you want to. Roam. No singing, Robin! It's not like it's pleasing to the ear. We got $1,940 to go to pull the horn's fat out of the fire. As to the manifesto, well, Matt in San Francisco says, I don't think we all need to see it. I'm for providing it to the professionals who study murderers, etc., but the rest of us just need the gist of it. A lot of these manifestos have coded language in them that inspires the next person to carry out another violent event. I tend to agree. Although I think there was value in what the sheriff of Jacksonville said over the weekend. He read from what the little monster, the little Nazi, left behind and shocked the conscience a bit of the country by using that word that has all the same letters as ginger out loud in public, and he himself, a black man, so that people could understand deeply, fully, and viscerally just how vile and vulgar the seething river of hate is that is running through our country. Been talking a little bit lately about COVID. And ABC News reporting COVID hospitalizations are on the increase for the sixth consecutive week. But, you know, the copy editor there had to have something happy to put in the headline. But still at historic lows. No, ABC News copy editor, they are not at historic lows. Historic lows for COVID-19 were like, you know, December of 2019, when it wasn't a problem yet. They jumped this week, COVID numbers across the United States, by 18.8%. That was the week ending August 19th. 15,067 people in hospital. That's commensurate with the numbers in April. The numbers are, according to public health officials, about 5.5 times lower compared to this week in 2021. Okay. And during the worst of it, the Omicron wave, 2021-2022, nationwide hospitalizations were at around 150,000. The CDC says that last week, about 1.7% of all deaths were due to COVID. And, you know, we're just going to pretend it doesn't exist anymore. Because it was so inconvenient, and it made the maggots and the anti-vaxxers have such a terrible, terrible butt hurt. And we don't like it when they're upset. Ever the optimist, Dr. John Segretti, and an epidemiologist at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago, said,
"Well, looking at that graph of hospitalizations, even though it's on an upward trend, that's still lower than it was this time last year. The fact that the numbers are going up fairly slowly, I think, is a good sign."
I think it's a sign that it's still freaking summer and a whole bunch of the country is still baking. And the new variant is out there. 13 whole cases have been identified globally. Oh, it's only 13. Three of them are in the U.S. It's called BA2.86. And there is a fear that it's more transmissible. The optimists are saying, yeah, but it doesn't make any more of a severe disease. A number of institutions are putting mask mandates back in place. In Atlanta, Morris Brown College and HBCU said they're reinstituting. A letter went out from President Dr. Kevin James. Over the next 14 days, all students and employees are required to wear face masks. Staff may remove in their offices while alone. Then there's Lionsgate Entertainment, who issued a statement saying the L.A. County Department of Public Health is requiring Lionsgate employees on the third and fifth floors of our 2700 Colorado Avenue headquarters in Santa Monica to wear masks due to a cluster of COVID cases. It's the policy of the L.A. County Department of Health to require masking in workplaces that have a cluster of cases.
That sounds a little whiny, doesn't it?
Hospitals are also reinstituting mask mandates for staff and patients and visitors. Meanwhile, over at Yale, at the Yale School of Public Health, Dr. Albert Koh, a professor there of epidemiology, said,
Well, I don't see that as something we're likely going to be adopting.
Yeah, why bother? The L.A. County Department of Public Health says COVID test positivity has increased. Well, don't worry. Everything's just, you know, fine. It's fine. Hey, Kim. Kim in New York writes in. Regarding COVID, one of my colleagues has COVID, as does one of my friends. Also, the stars of Broadway's Sweeney Todd were out with it. I saw it on Saturday, and fortunately, Josh Groban was back. He was amazing. Oh, God, being able to go to Broadway shows. I am so jealous, Kim. Ah. And Sweeney Todd's a great show. Demon Barber of Fleet Street. In answer to the question you asked at the front of that, no, haven't in ages. Interesting clip from Rachel Maddow. Don't often play, but Rachel got her hands on the transcript because, remember, in federal court, we, the people of the United States, trying desperately to form and or preserve that more perfect union, we're not able to see unless we're able to go to the physical courtroom because, after all, we still live in the 19th century and there's no such thing as electronic video or audio transmission or anything. No. So we are limited to bad courtroom sketch artists and the pixel-stained wretches sitting in the in the courtroom to tell us what actually went on. But like I said, over at MSNBC, Rachel Maddow got hold of the transcript and read some segments of the Donnybrook between Trump pettifogger John Lauro and U.S. District Court Judge Tanya Chutkan, who, I should remind, John Lauro is the judge and not him. This is actually pretty good. You can always tell. You know, the other night when Nitwit Nero went briefly to jail, yeah, Rachel Maddow and Joy Reid were very near. It was almost like they were at brunch. They came very close to giggling. They may have actually, I mean, there was much smirking going on, and one or both of them may have actually giggled somewhere along the way.
We got the transcript. Okay. Quote, the deputy clerk, good morning, Your Honor. This is criminal case number 23-257, United States of America versus Donald J. Trump. Counsel, please approach the lectern and state your appearance for the record. Ms. Gaston, the prosecutor. Good morning, Your Honor. Molly Gaston for the United States, along with Thomas Windham. The judge, good morning. Mr. Lauro, the defense lawyer. Good morning, Your Honor. John Lauro on behalf of President Trump. With me is my partner, Greg Singer, and Todd Blanche, who has noticed an appearance as well as co-counsel for President Trump. The judge, all right. Good morning, everyone. We are here for a hearing regarding the party's proposed trial dates. So this was the hearing today in federal court in D.C. to set a date for the trial of Donald Trump in one of the four criminal trials that he is currently facing. This is the case about him trying to falsify the election results. It's the federal case about that. What this means in practical terms is that this hearing today was basically the opportunity for Trump's lawyers to defend their argument that they've already made to the court in print, that Trump's trial, federal trial for trying to overturn the election results, shouldn't start for another 2.5 years. It shouldn't start until 2026. Today was the hearing where they were going to defend that argument. Today, Judge Tanya Chutkan, federal judge in D.C., made clear they are not going to get their 2026 wish, but how she got there was kind of amazing. The judge, quote, "Now, I want to note here that setting a trial date does not depend and should not depend on a defendant's personal and professional obligations. Mr. Trump, like any defendant, will have to make the trial date work regardless of his schedule. If this case, for example, involved a professional athlete, it would be inappropriate for me to schedule a trial date to accommodate her schedule. The same is true here. Among other things, the public has an interest in the fair and timely administration of justice, as well as reducing defendants' opportunity to commit crimes while on pretrial release, and preventing extended pretrial delay from impairing the deterrent effect of punishment." Prosecutors then tried to sort of bolster that point from the judge. Ms. Gaston, the prosecutor, says, quote, "The defendant, formerly the senior most official in our federal government, is accused of historic crimes, attempting to overturn the presidential election, disenfranchise millions of Americans, and obstruct the peaceful transfer of power. There's an incredibly strong public interest in a jury's prompt and full consideration of those claims in open court. And there's also a strong public interest in a fair trial, which means we need to proceed to trial as soon as the defense can be ready reasonably. Because on a near daily basis, the defendant posts on social media about this case. He has publicly disparaged witnesses. He's attacked the integrity of the courts and of the citizens of the District of Columbia who make up our jury pool. And this potentially prejudices the jury pool. So under the Speedy Trial Act, Your Honor, we need to find a time for trial when, well, as soon as the defense can reasonably be ready." So that's the judge saying, listen, the public has an interest in a speedy trial here. That's the prosecutor saying, oh, yes, they do. When the judge, though, attempts to have a discussion about what would be a reasonable amount of time for Trump's defense lawyers to go through all the evidence, that was a very heated portion of today's hearing. The judge found herself repeatedly instructing Trump's lawyer basically to calm down. Quote, "Mr. Lauro, defense counsel, this is a request for a show trial, not a speedy trial. And I'm sorry, Your Honor, to suggest for a federal prosecutor to suggest that we could go to trial in 4 months is not only absurd, but it's a violation of the oath to do justice. And let me just go through this organized material." And then the judge interrupts. The judge, "Okay, let's take the temperature down for a moment here." But Trump's lawyer goes on, "Mr. Lauro, quote, for the government to suggest that I can do that in 4 months is an outrage to justice. That not once have they talked about justice in this case, not once. So what? This is what I have to do. Now, they can give me key documents. That's very nice of them. That's very kind of them. I'd like to know one defense lawyer in the United States that's going to rely on a government's proposal of key documents." The judge, "Mr. Lauro, as I said, let's take the temperature down." In the end, Judge Chutkan scheduled the trial for March 4th, not of 2026, but of next year. The judge says, quote, "The offense giving rise to this case occurred at the end of 2020 and the beginning of 2021. To propose trying this case over 5 years later risks the real danger that witnesses may become unavailable or their memories may fade. And while Mr. Trump has a right to time to prepare, the public has a right to a prompt and efficient resolution of this matter. This timeline does not move the case forward with the haste of the mob. The trial will start 3 years, 1 month, and 27 days after the events of January 6th, 2021. So March 4th, jury selection begins. Here's one other thing that Judge Chutkan said today I think is worth noting and actually worth getting some advice about. The judge said today, quote, "I realize that Mr. Trump's criminal case in New York is scheduled for trial on March 25th. I did speak briefly with Judge Mershon, the New York judge, to let him know that I was considering a date that might overlap with his trial." So she's explaining the two sides, why she's picking this date, noting that it's up against the New York date. But she says she's spoken to the judge. interesting. I mean, Trump obviously has many trials coming up in the next year. There is that one in New York on dozens of state felony charges. There's also the classified documents trial in federal court in Florida. And prosecutors in those various cases may not themselves be talking to each other, but the judges apparently are talking to each other. Judge Chutkan saying in open court today that she has spoken to the judge, for example, in Trump's New York case, to give him a heads up, to help deconflict between at least those two trials. And while that might seem common sense, that's the first time we have seen anyone in any position of authority playing the role of air traffic controllers for all of these trials that are all going to be trying to land in the same year. And that happened on a day we got a surprise preview of what's going to happen in the Georgia trial, thanks to a surprise courtroom appearance from Trump's White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows. Lots happened today. We've got Chuck Rosenberg.
Ta-da! And I appreciate the sort of adorable, tongue-in-cheek, dramatic reading that Rachel gave us there. What I object to, however, is the fact that we have to rely on dramatic readings from Rachel Maddow, no matter how good she is at it. I would say the same were it a dramatic reading from, you know, moi. It is 2023. Not having cameras and microphones in the courthouse partakes of a courthouse that is not truly open. It is a truism of the American so-called system of justice, or system of so-called justice, that the doors of the courthouse shall be open to all. In a country of some 330 to 350 million souls, forcing all but maybe 50 of them, 100 at 100 tops, to rely on a sketch artist, transcripts, and hastily thumbed in updates from reporters, well, that's a closed courthouse. That's a closed courtroom. That is a court whose doors are not open to all. Because in 2023, amen, the open doors of a courtroom mean cameras and microphones. And I frankly do not give a flying fig what our most puissant, dread sovereign, supreme Catholic majesties think about that. The way the federal court rules deal with availability to the public of the proceedings is about one notch above Star Chamber. And it's only that one notch because they let the defendant actually be there. And that transcript, well, you learn to pay attention, and I know Steve in New York and Billable Rick, if he's listening, and Darlene, probably picked this up too. Yeah, noteworthy is what's not there. I want to go back for just a minute to what Mr. Lauro said.
Wyndham, the judge, good morning. Mr. Lauro, the defense lawyer. Good morning, Your Honor. John Lauro on behalf of President Trump. With me is my partner, Greg Singer, and Todd Blanche, who has noticed an appearance as well as co-counsel for President Trump.
There. That. In criminal cases, the presence of the defendant is almost always required. And when the defendant is present, what the lawyer says is, "Good morning, Your Honor. John Lauro, present in person, on behalf of President Trump, who is present in person and by counsel." I'm beginning to wonder if the ponderous, shambling, demented orange circus peanut was even there. But we don't get told that in the clip. If he wasn't there, why wasn't he there? Was it a hardship for him to fuel up that rickety-ass old Boeing? You know, the one he finally found an engine for after searching for several years, found an engine up on blocks in front of a single wide at the verges of the Okefenokee Swamp or where the hell ever? And if he wasn't there, why was there not a bit of a stink raised about it? Because, believe you me, for setting a trial date, and I know anybody who has ever done criminal law, setting a trial date, your client, if you're the defense, your client's sitting there right with you so that the client can hear the trial date too. It came in New York. Judge Chutkan has better impulse control than I. I don't know how Judge Chutkan's able to stop herself from interrupting Trump attorney Lauro when he constantly calls Trump President Trump by saying, "You mean Mr. Trump." It would be a challenge. Although she has to watch every word, because every word a pettifogger like Lauro could and would object. And so if she's going to say anything, she would say, "Counselor, I think you mean former President Trump." Former is an adjective that modifies president. Your client may wish to go about the country braying about how the election was stolen from him, but the fact remains that he is not the President of the United States. Jeremy says he may have been there via GoToMeeting or some such thing where he could hear the proceedings and give feedback to his pettifoggers. That would have been noted on the record. And President Trump and former President Trump is present by counsel and in person via remote feed. But again, there are no cameras allowed in the courtroom, so nope. I find this a little bit disturbing. This smells an awful lot like special treatment. Lee in New York, judge scheduling trial based on other trials. We have not had a cowbell yet today. Give one to the judge for trying not to overfill Nitwit Nero's dance card or court calendar. I try to be cooperative. So was he up golf? Did he have an early morning tea time at his tacky ass golf motel? Where was he? Was he all worn out from flying to Atlanta from New Jersey last Thursday? Did he need some time to recover? We have got to have cameras for these trials. We absolutely must. Because with no cameras in the trials, there are no cameras in the courtroom.
We don't have it all.
Oh, stop. I forgot to plug something in. Never mind. Wait a minute. Must be nice to have a producer. Like I said, though, if they are not confronted with live video and audio, the legitimacy of this prosecution will be forever tainted. And the maggots will never actually hear the evidence. I mean, I guess it'll be great ratings fodder for, oh, say, cherry-picking the testimony if you're Fox News TV Radio Rwanda. Or cherry-picking the testimony if you're any other member of the multimillionaire for-profit media. There will be documentaries made. There will be fictional... I mean, how long did it take for us to get the White House plumbers? Granted, all the president's men... It was not that long after Watergate. Dustin Hoffman and Robert Redford. But things like the White House plumber, 2023? There were things that happened in 1973? Last I checked, that's 50 years, even by my... lousy ciphering. Yeah. At some point in time, this bubble is going to have to pop. It is morally and judicially wrong the American people not to be able to watch every second of every proceeding. And imagine having the hubris of a John Lauro to sit there and argue openly with an Article III federal judge, a federal trial court judge. Matt in San Francisco asks, can an average citizen sue to get cameras in the courtroom? Would they be found to have standing? If bringing a suit would be a path to cameras inside, let's go for it. Seems like there isn't really a downside. Yeah, the only way you can create standing is Glenn Kirshner's argument about being a victim and victims having a right to witness the proceedings regarding charges against the person who victimized them. That really is about it. But speaking of Glenn Kirshner, Mark sent along a clip. Hi, Mark. Former federal prosecutor Glenn Kirshner sat in the courtroom, not in the press section. Excellent interview concerning the very subjects you're discussing. Okay, let's see what we get here.
Believe based on the evidence, the verdict will be guilty, and then it will just be a matter of sentencing Donald Trump. So, you know, if he's still in the race for president, he's going to be a convicted felon, and he may very well find himself in prison.
Now, who decides what the sentence is? Is it the judge or the jury here?
Wait, what? What kind of question is that? Never mind. The thing is, We have the example of the Steve Bannon conviction to sort of guide us here. Glenn Kirshner says he will be found guilty. I mean, this is a level of certainty that's right up there with Joe Namath predicting victory for the New York Jets over the Baltimore Colts in Super Bowl III. Everybody thought Joe Namath was insane. The Jets could never possibly beat the mighty Colts. And yet they did. And then the question, who sentences him? The judge or the jury? Sentences? But again, we have the Bannon case to sort of track this with us. And if he is convicted, say sometime, Jack Smith has said 4 to 6 weeks to put on the government's case in chief. If the trial actually starts on March the 4th, that means somewhere around tax day, April 15th, 2024, the government will rest. We have no idea what John Lauro will do, except, and this goes back to why wasn't he in the courtroom. I think he is so bad off, Nitwit Nero, that he can't even sit in a courtroom. We've asked the question time and again, how will he sit through 6 weeks of having all of his multitude of crimes and sins laid out in public, laid bare, with him having to simply sit there and take it? I don't think he can even sit still during a scheduling conference for the trial date. Your Honor, I'm going to be busy campaigning. Counselor, control your client.
This isn't fair. I caught them. I caught them with the strawberries. Right?
But let's hear the question.
It's exclusively the judge. So judges are guided by what's called the federal sentencing guidelines, which give the judge some parameters of what kind of a sentence would be appropriate for a given offender based on the convictions and based on his prior history, criminal history, social history. And the judge has broad discretion. And frankly, the judge doesn't even have to follow the federal sentencing guidelines. They almost always do. Years ago, the federal sentencing guidelines were mandatory. Judges could not depart or they'd get appealed, but the Supreme Court changed that several years ago. And now it's just a guide. They are discretionary, they're non-mandatory, but judges almost always follow them.
Okay, and is there any reason to believe that Trump would get sentenced in a way that's either grossly under what we would expect for something, for someone who commits a crime like this, or above?
I think it unlikely. You know, both parties, that is the defense attorneys and the prosecutors, can make a motion to depart downward from the federal sentencing guidelines and go with a really low number, or the prosecutors, if it's a truly egregious crime, like, you know, trying to end our democracy, they can file a motion to go above the guidelines. Frankly, it wouldn't surprise me if we see both of those motions filed. The defense will go way too low, and the prosecution, I'm biased, is probably going to go appropriately high given the gravity of these offenses.
Now, let's say Donald Trump is convicted and he inevitably appeals. Can he be released pending appeal?
The answer is he can be, yes, but defendants are almost never allowed to be on release pending appeal if they've been convicted and sentenced to prison. You know, there's one outlier
that
comes. We can look at for an example of that, and that is the Bannon case. A Trump-appointed judge, Judge Nichols, presided over the Bannon case. The jury convicted him hands down. Unfortunately, the judge imposed a pretty lenient sentence, just 4 years in prison. And then Judge Nichols did something that I thought was outrageous, and it actually outraged the legal community, including a number of judges, based on what I've heard. He let Steve Bannon stay out. He let him go home pending appeal rather than report to the Bureau of Prisons to serve his four-month sentence. And Bannon is still out, still making mischief, still throwing bombs. And that was just a dead wrong decision by Judge Nichols. But it is within the judge's discretion to say, I'm going to sentence you to prison, but I'm going to leave you out until your appeal has run.
Okay, so
ta-da. And there is the answer to our question. Would Judge Chutkan let him remain at large? I mean, well, you are running a presidential campaign. I guess that's your stay-out-of-jail-free card. And by the way, Steve in New York looked up Rule 43A of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. Unless this rule, Rule 5 or Rule 10, provides otherwise, the defendant must be present at 1, the initial appearance, the initial arraignment, and the plea. 2, every trial stage, including jury impanelment and the return of the verdict. And 3, sentencing. So maybe the scheduling conference to establish the trial date doesn't qualify as a trial stage, that it is simply preliminary. And I guess he wouldn't, in that case, would a, for instance, would a motion in limine, a motion to exclude evidence, would that qualify as the trial stage? I don't know. Never practiced in the federal courts. Billable Rick, if you're out there and wanted to jump in, that could be really helpful. Oh, and Darlene says, not only all you say, but last time I checked, we have one president at a time. Loro should not be permitted to get away with calling that orange, ugly-ass defendant President Trump. Former he is, that ugly-ass MF-er with whom I am sick of hearing his childish, narcissistic rants just about every 2 seconds. I'm sick of his mania being foisted upon us. Yeah, kind of reminds you of what Henry II is alleged to have said about Thomas a Becket. Will no one rid me of this meddlesome priest? That was just a statement of frustration, as at least as it's understood. Well, some of the barons took it a little too literally. Now, Ralph said, I looked up Trump yesterday and Trump Monday and found nothing. I was probably on his golf course, you know, cheating, even though he was playing by himself. We talked about that this past Friday. Let's run over to the stress line and see who we've got. Hey, welcome to the program.
And an orange, ugly-ass MF-er he is.
Amen. I conjured you. Hi, Darlene.
I was just going to say that. You've been conjuring me, so here I am. I agree. There should be cameras. I don't know if Judge Chutkan wants to be the first one to break that rule at the federal level of no cameras.
Yeah, but the judicial conference, she doesn't have to be. The judicial conference actually has that jurisdiction. Granted, old balls and strikes John Roberts sits on it, but it's made up of appeals court judges, trial court judges. Old balls and strikes John Roberts. And frankly, I'm sorry, I don't mean to fill a lobster on you, Darlene. But the worst thing that ever happened to American judicial process was the O.J. trial. And
the what?
The O.J. trial. And you know, Jay Leno and his dancing Ito and the fact that it was turned into a comedy bit.
Well, I think people have to loudly complain and insist because Glenn Kirshner is right. This is a very unique situation. And essentially, we are victims, the American people, minus the maggots. I think no matter what you do with them, they're hopeless. It's not going to matter. But for sane, normal people who care about this constitutional democracy, fledgling though it is, you know,
aspirational, not operational. Yeah.
aspirational, not operational. And Judge Chutkan, who's clearly brilliant, she's clearly no nonsense, all of that. I think she's going to be ingratiating. Maybe not ingratiating. That's probably.
I think she's going to be a Vulcan.
Well, I don't know. I mean, she offered the report is, and again, we cannot judge for ourselves. We have to rely on what those few individuals, including Glenn Kirshner, who can get a ticket in there, tell us. But she offered Lorio several opportunities to come up with an alternative hearing date.
And he kept insisting on the day after the sun burns out.
Exactly. And so I think she's going to walk that really fine line so she does not get overturned. To give that orange asshole as many opportunities as possible, which, you know, clearly, he's still going to bitch and moan and complain, and he was doing it the next day, doing it today. He's still going to harass and harangue and everything, but I think she's thinking of, you know, within the legal orbit, trying to run this as clean as possible and giving him as many opportunities as possible. I'm not sanguine about her letting him, you know, keeping him in the brig if he loses on appeal.
Hold on. It's not if he loses on appeal. If he loses at trial.
When he appeals.
She has the right to schedule a sentencing hearing and tell him to bring his toothbrush.
But I thought that you had just played something, maybe I misunderstood, that Glenn Kirshner was saying that he used the Bannon example. Because he's still out and about walking around. I don't know why.
And what Kirshner said was that lawyers and judges alike were outraged by the maggot judge's behavior in that, but that, unfortunately...
It was a maggot judge. Okay.
It remains in the judge's sole discretion.
Well, then, in that case, then I changed my viewpoint on that. It was hard for me to hear it because it was very distant, very low, but what I guess with Judge Chutkan, considering the very, considering that she gave sentences to the January 6th insurrectionists that were longer than even what the government asked for, I mean, she came down pretty hard on them, then I hope that, or it looks, maybe it does look good that she will show that asshole no mercy. That is my hope. I don't know. Todd could be right that Trump is not going to be able to handle sitting in that court day in and day out, being unable to speak. But then again, people have noted that, including his niece, Mary Trump, that when he gets into these authoritarian, even though he is an authoritarian himself or has that personality and desperately wants to be dictator of the world, king of the world, usually people like him know only one of two realities. Either they're in control or they're being controlled. And so it has been widely noted, widely reported, that when he gets into a situation where he doesn't have the control, like in the court, like when he's being booked, he's very submissive.
Yeah, when he thinks he can exert some level of control, like that infamous clip of him testifying in Congress about, Indian gaming,
Excuse me. I need to speak. Excuse me. Try
that in a federal court. That's not a congressional hearing.
So he might sit there totally, you know, mute and submissive, you
cowed,
know,
cowed,
shoulders, etc.
Yeah, given his vast 215 pounds of 6'3", he might sit there cowed.
Well, then again, if he knows the cameras are on him, that could be, you know, a whole different scenario, like in Georgia. So maybe there's a catch-22. Well, everything with him is a catch-22, right? I mean,
yeah, the norms all go out the window.
You know? Because if there's cameras in the room, he's got to be on. You know, he's got to be. He's on display. I think cameras could make him a very different person, as opposed to no cameras.
Well, you know, he's going to sit there in his chair like he's taking a dump, like he always does. You've seen it. I mean, am I wrong? Is what it looks like?
No.
As to the cameras, see, Judge Chutkan maybe she could sua sponte suggest to the judicial conference that this was of sufficient gravity that there deserved to be cameras in the courtroom. But what needs to happen is that somehow or another pressure is put on the judicial conference to get them to let it be their own idea. Hmm. So like what Glenn Kirshner said, I am a victim of crime. Yeah. I deserve the right to witness this trial.
Exactly. It's a one-off, they could say. This is a one-off, kind of like Bush v. Gore, right? This is a one-off.
Right. But by the same token, that becomes problematic because you're only doing it because it's Donald Trump.
Yeah, but no one's ever done what he's done. You know? This is all unprecedented. So the way that it was framed as well, you know, by Jack Smith, right? I mean, this is a unique situation, which we hope will never happen again. Well, you never say never. But I think we have standing. Thinking, you know, again, it'll probably be like when you talk about the maggots, forget them, right? I mean, Fox News never showed the January 6th hearings. Never showed any of that. And we assume that the maggots watch that, right? So it's unlikely, although the biggest, you know, next OJ, you mentioned OJ's trial. Next to that, I suppose we could say, this is the biggest trial in history. Maybe they would show it. And try to skew it.
If they thought there were ratings in it, you're damn right they would.
You know? But they didn't do that with January 6th. But I don't give a rat's ass about the maggots. They can go pound sand. Because they're just hopeless. But the rest of us, inquiring minds, want to know. I want to see, I want to judge for myself. You know, I want to see what, you know, I want to glean my own impressions of what's going on instead of being told.
I think we all do.
So, but it's tricky too because
I wasn't trying to be a bitch about Rachel Maddow. I appreciate what she did. But
no, you raise a very good point. You raised an excellent point that, you know, why are we having to have her read this to us, narrate this to us? We should be able to watch it, and maybe things like that will get more people aggravated and agitated and saying, why aren't we able to watch this, like in Georgia, when that comes up? So there are still problems with the system. Again, she's in the federal system. You know, she may not be, you know, I know you're saying it would be the judicial conference, but I don't know if they want to open that can of worms. We know the Supreme Court certainly doesn't, and they're too old school for the rest of us. It's, you know, we can listen to them, but there's a lot to be said by affect. There's a lot to be said for actually watching the person as they're speaking, as they're asking the question, as they're
right. And that's why constitutional law expressly includes the right of the accused to confront his accusers.
Yes.
Because if you say no, I didn't, but at the same time you're sitting in the witness chair, squirming like you've got ants in your pants, a jury reads that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this just seems intolerable.
And it opens things up for the maggots to do far more conjecturing as to what went down than they should be permitted to do. Again, not that I care about them, because they're hopeless, they're useless. But if people can point to and say, watch the video feed, watch the TV feed. Go online, look at it. It's all there.
That's right. And in fact, to that extent, it's like the J6 Commission. You know, don't sit there as a member of Meal Team 6 banging away at your keyboard, warrior. Watch the hearing. If this is a Democrat conspiracy against your God Emperor, sure is kind of wild that they got the cooperation of nothing but Republicans. But of course they didn't. But of course the maggots didn't watch.
Well, and they're, you know, for all of their, you know, First Amendment and freedom of speech, it's bullshit. It's freedom of a certain kind of speech that they approve of, because they, once the maggots, ultra maggots, hey, I'm going to call them what they are, once they took over the House, barely, they took down all of the information of the January 6th documents and the hearings and the video and everything. So the January 6th committee wound up posting it on a separate website. They said, oh, you're not doing that. You're not going to hide or conceal that. And I think it was Adam Kinzinger who put out the URL so you can still see it. But that's what they did. Because they don't want the marketplace of ideas. They don't want that.
Right. All they want is bias confirmation.
Yes. So I say the more we can put the sunshine on it, like was it Justice Brandeis said?
Yeah, you know, the better. The sun is the best disinfectant.
Yeah. So, but I don't know, how does it get to the judicial conference to look at it? Does Judge Chuckin put an inquiry to them? How does that happen?
Well, one thing that can happen,
I mean,
is
we know that,
that I mean, I think, in answer to your question, Darlene, I'm pretty sure that a letter-writing campaign is already underway from several members of Congress, members of the House and the Senate.
Yes, I was just going to say that.
That's appropriate. But then again, old Balls and Strikes sits there, and I guess he runs the joint.
Yeah, who runs who? I don't know. Who's zooming who over there? Because, you know, based on what Sheldon Whitehouse says, it sounds like the Judicial Conference has some power over the Supreme Court, trying to set up ethics rules and things like that. I don't know. You're saying that he's got a lot of sway. He's sitting on that Judicial Conference. I don't know who's zooming who over there. That's all I want to know. So we have a letter. I mean, Kirshner, I think, did something, right? Yes, Jamie Raskin and other representatives have put forward a request. Hey, look, you know, the American people should be able to watch this. So it goes to the Judicial Conference. It completely bypasses the judges. They have no say in this. Is that, or do they? I would think she would have a say.
Only if that discretion is given to her.
Well, it's her case. It's her courtroom. You know, and who knows? I don't know how she would side. I would think she would.
It's her courtroom, but it is not her court. And she has to operate within the rules established by. Well, I mean, look. Okay, so we're back to ethics again. I've even got a funny story to go with it. There is a code of judicial ethics for U.S. U.S. magistrates, for U.S. district court judges, for U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals judges. There is a code of ethics for everyone but the Supreme Court. And that's a fact.
And that's convenient.
And so, if it is the diktat of the Judicial Conference that we don't have cameras in courtrooms, she has no discretion to go against that. And I said there was a funny story, speaking of Supreme Court ethics. A while back, and you know, it's made it to the news, but a while back there was news coverage of the 112 former law clerks of Clarence Thomas who swore that he's absolutely ethical. Mm-hmm. And this is after he got caught, you know, taking vacations with Har Har and Jin Jin and Lili. Letter was signed by 112 former Supreme Court clerks to Fappy Thomas. The letter, which is best heard with the backdrop of a tinny whorehouse piano, reads in part, "As his law clerks, we offer this response. Different paths led us to our year with Justice Thomas, and we have followed very different paths since. But along the way, we all saw with our own eyes the same thing. His integrity is unimpeachable, and his independence is unshakable. Deeply rooted 7 decades ago as that young child who walked through the door of his grandparents' house, for a life forever changed." Do you need a tissue? I need a tissue.
Utter crap.
I'm for Clint. that letter, whatever value it had, A, none of those clerks ever got to go on a $500,000 vacation with their boss to a secret beach in Indonesia or anything like that. Oh, we don't know anything about that. Oh, but oh my goodness gracious. And, yeah, such integrity he has. Well, I think that stirring testimonial letter's sun has set, Darlene. Care to know why?
I would love to know why. Do tell.
Because one of the signatories to it was John Eastman, the man who came up with the scheme to overturn the Constitution of the United States. Whoopsie!
There's a punchline. Wow.
Isn't that beautiful?
That is just glorious. It's one of those, I mean, even when you were reading, I'm like, you know, this is one of these things where the, you know, the American people are just, you know, the same ones, you know, like us, that we are ahead of the curve. Like, we see that this is all bullshit because we're outside the Beltway. This is kind of inside the Beltway crap. But, you know.
Well, a law professor at Texas A&M by the name of Milan Markovich said, this is powerful evidence of how broken the clerking system is. Clerks' careers are tied to their justices, so they resort to platitudes to defend the indefensible. Bonus points for including Eastman and John Yoo, though. John Yoo was on the letter, yeah. And then over at that microblogging platform owned by derpy Batman villain Leon Scum, somebody said, I mean, currently indicted in Georgia, former Trump lawyer John Eastman used to clerk for Justice Clarence Thomas, but sure, let's hear what the rest of his former clerks have to say about Thomas's integrity.
Yep. It's gross. The whole thing is gross. And, you know, I quite frankly think that the Senate Ethics Committee or Judiciary Committee, whichever one that Durbin and White House sit on, I think they're going too easy on the Supreme Court. I really do. They're going too easy on them. As they continue to rip apart the social fabric and create problems while they go off on those fancy junkets for the summer, and they're coming back soon, and it's like, oh God, they're coming back. No, what destructive thing are they going to do next?
And see, after yesterday's events in her courtroom, Judge Chutkan, and again, thank you, Rachel, but she was still at work today. So today, with no pettifoggers in the room, she dealt with 6 motions in the federal cases against Nitwit Nero. And, well, Nitwit Nero went 0-6. One document was described as a brief in support of Donald Trump. She denied a petition for writ of habeas corpus. She just, you can imagine her standing out in the field with a pump action shotgun saying, pull, bang, pull, bang, pull, bang, 6-6. And you'd love to be a fly on the wall just to hear, you know, did these people actually get out of law school? Really?
Oh, yeah. And talking with the security guards and the clerks in the court? Oh, yeah. Are you serious? What's going on here?
I swear next week they're going to show up with floppy shoes and big red rubber noses.
She's hilarious. I mean, just some of the photos of her. She just looks like she's hilarious. She looks like she is a fun person, and she loves what she does, but she's no bullshit. And honestly, the based on everything that I've heard, Loria was absolutely disrespectful to her. She was highly, highly tolerant of his absolute disrespect in her courtroom. He was a real prick. So it was kind of going back to that. What if you have the law on your side, pounding the law, if you have the facts, pounding the facts, you don't have either pound on the table. He was doing an awful lot of table pounding.
Oh, the table has dents in it.
He must have, more or less his reticence to compromise, even though she offered him multiple opportunities, his stubbornness on this point, he must have been told by Trump under no circumstances yield on this. And it fucked him up even more because he probably, was more afraid of Trump's reaction than, doing the best thing for his client, which would have been to offer an alternative because, he could have said something like, how about after November, maybe December 2024? And she probably would have split the difference. She probably would have said, she probably would have given a few more months, maybe a little bit more beyond March. Although pretty clear she was thinking March because she spoke with or reached out to the other judge there in New York, who they've maligned terribly, the Trump crew there, Marchand.
Yeah.
to just be sure she wasn't, she wasn't going to be stepping over him too much. And of course, he sounds like a gentleman and somebody, he would defer to her without question in terms of the timing. But he probably could have gotten a few more months out of her. She probably would have split the difference and he would have had more time to prepare.
Right. But part of this strategy is that he couldn't give ground because that would look like some sort of agreement. And they're already planning their appeal strategy because I think John Morrow knows he's going to lose. And so the appeal strategy has to has to be one in which they object, and never agree with anything Judge Chutkan does. And let's also remember, because even at the rarefied atmospheric levels of the federal judiciary, Judge Chutkan is still a woman and still black. And so you know what's being said up at Bed Monster or down at Mogalardass.
Yep.
I found it interesting that CNN gave a holler to Andrew McCabe to get his take on how he viewed Nitwit Nero's behavior relative to Judge Chutkan. And along those lines, the fact that he's still attacking her. He's on social media calling her everything but a child of God.
Right. Today, very next day.
And he's doing the same with Jack Smith. And he is only enjoined from attacking witnesses or co-defendants. So he is attacking his targets of opportunity. On the other hand, if he is found guilty at a sentencing hearing, a pretrial sentencing report can consider anything it wants to consider. And this could it could work out poorly for him. But I thought this clip was interesting. Andrew McCabe talking to John Berman over at CNN.
Down. I mean, that's a sign. How might that carry into the trial itself?
Well, she is setting the tone of her courtroom and the expectations in her courtroom clearly and early. And so as they proceed, they will understand that she is going to set the nature of how this trial is conducted. So I expect she won't have difficulty because she does run the courtroom, have the ability to reprimand counsel, direct how the attorneys handle themselves in her courtroom. The harder part will be, and this gets back to your early question about how the politics will play into it, the harder part for her, I think, will be managing the activities and the public communications and the statements of the defendant himself in the campaign season.
Andy McCabe, you know a little something about the public communications of the former president of the United States. You've been on the receiving end of tweets of his. What do you make of how Judge Chutkan is handling that and the message she is sending about how they will be viewed?
I think she's doing a fine job so far. I think we're, as Carrie intimated, we have a lot of ground to cover here. There's certainly going to be a lot of opportunities for the former president to flare out in the way that he prefers to on social media. You know, he's never met a line that he didn't cross or a norm that he didn't break. And so I wonder how effective, if the judge finds herself in a position to having to set limits or you know, chide him for his activities in the social media space, I really feel like that will have just a provoking effect on him. So it's hard to see how those two forces working in opposite directions end up in a good place at the end of the day. But I have to tell you that I think all signs so far are that this judge is very much in control of her courtroom. She's going to run this calendar the way she sees fit. And the defendant is just going to have to go along with it.
And Jessica, what does that portend in terms of the timing here? As, you know, as Carrie pointed out, federal trials get moved. Just because it's set for March 4th doesn't mean it'll be March 4th. But is it more likely than not that this is concluded by at least Election Day?
Well, it would seem that this judge is committed to getting this case tried close to the date that she has set and before the election, if at all possible. She may not be able to control everything. It depends what transpires. It will also depend on what motions are filed and how quickly she's able to rule on those motions and whether there's an effort to appeal her decision on any of those motions. So not everything is going to be within her control, but I think what we've seen thus far from this judge is a strong commitment to the public interest in a speedy trial here.
I love how the for-profit media, Darlene, keep trying to avoid the obvious, something we've talked about here, i.e., how what's the over-under on his mob boss stroke? You know, the plaid blanket, the drooling, the wheelchair.
Right, yeah. That's still in his back pocket, yeah.
Oh, I have a dumb question to ask of you. And this is entirely off topic.
There are no dumb questions.
Well, I find myself thinking some ugly thoughts. And I need your input on this because, you know, this is your community. You know how much I hate Greg Aspott. And mm-hmm. You know, the governor of Texas, and I don't think you're a fan either.
Mm-mm.
And I caught myself
with an insult to disabled people everywhere.
Right, and well,
he's an insult to disabled people everywhere. Go ahead.
Well, I remembered something a rather hilarious person I knew many years ago once remarked, and it. And I never wanted to say it on air unless I had, like, permission from you or someone else who has to use a mobility assistive device. But am I out of line? I'm sorry. Am I out of line in occasionally thinking that I wish somebody would get Greg Aspott going at a nice head of steam and stick a broom handle in his spokes?
Uh,
No, because he's an asshole.
Because I never wanted to say that on air and get an email back from you going, you insensitive bitch.
I don't know. I mean.
But you giggled. You giggled. You definitely giggled. I heard that. That was a giggle.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that would be something. Well, you know, I don't know. I'm in a power chair, so you ain't doing shit like that to somebody in a power chair. So I guess I have one up on Greg Ocbot. I don't know. He's it's like Mitch McConnell, you know, ought to know better. Somebody that.
Yeah, Mitch McConnell, relative to polio.
Had a disability, had, you know, and they could do so much to help people in our situations who are disabled. Same thing with that, was it Collie, you know? If you were to say, if you were to say something like that about Tammy Duckworth, I'd have an issue with you.
And I never would.
Because she's a good person. But, and you never would.
But Greg Ocbot is a...
you know?
He's a shit human being. He was a shit human being before the tree fell on him and a shit human being after the tree fell on him.
Right. You just want to smack him upside the head regardless of what he's sitting in or what is, you know... He's just a shit bird. And that's what you're seeing. Beyond the and in a sense, because of his situation, he ought to know better. He ought to have more empathy. Then again, there are different gradations of this. You know what I mean? It's sort of like somebody like myself who has a genetic disposition is probably considered less than somebody like a Tammy Duckworth. Who is almost more acceptable because she was in, you know, she was maimed in when she was in the military.
Military service, right.
So, you know, somebody like her, like she, you would look at her and say, well, she's a real hero in service to this country. There's something... there's something that would you would look at that and say that you know that there's courage there, there's heroism there, there's it's almost like it's more acceptable, you know. Same thing with FDR, you know. FDR now easier in terms of him being so, you know, quote unquote cut down due to polio, which I question. I don't think he had that.
But since you went there, by the way, did you catch the Wee-Wek Ramaswamy moment where he started going on about would we have won the Second World War if FDR hadn't had polio?
No, I didn't hear that.
It was so insane. I don't think I can even accurately describe it.
Yeah, that's just bullshit. And again, it's just crazy shit that will just, you know. But finishing my thought on that, I think that in some respects, and in many respects, they're both, even if it's genetically based. It's still a tough life.
Lord, yes.
It's not, and it's not, and it's even in some ways, it's even more difficult because it's like, I didn't want this, you know? And especially if it's progressive. So you've been in a situation where, you know, you used to be able to walk well. You used to be able to climb stairs in my situation. You used to be able to get out of chairs without a problem. It was, you know, and now it's a different scenario entirely. And you're like, you can't remember what it was like. The brain plasticity, all of that stuff. And it's frustrating every single day. It's frustrating. You know, it takes a person a couple of seconds to get up out of bed. Me, I timed it today because it's frustrating. It took me at least a minute, you know, to do the transfer, get everything right, do the transfer, pain in the ass. That makes me no less heroic than a Tammy Duckworth. You know,
it's because it's the same struggle it's the same struggle in real time.
And Greg Aspott, you know, if he wasn't such a prick, I have empathy for him. I have empathy. I would have, like, you know, prior to his latest fall, Mitch McConnell, you know, I've seen him try to navigate a stairs without railings. You know, if I was an able-bodied person, my first inclination would be to give him an arm and help him out, you know, because it's not easy. He's, you know, but he's, there are just some people that are just, they have to rationalize that kind of situation, I think, out of their heads. And I don't know. I don't know what goes on. I guess the disability really, I don't know. I mean, you look at it, Caitlyn Jenner, you know, she's kind of the bad guy in terms of people who are trans. You know, Greg Aspott,
one of the good ones.
You know, as you say mockingly, you know, so. In some respects, you look at the situation, you're like, you ought to know better. You should know better. This makes no sense. So, yeah, when he's doing things like, you know, putting shredding, you know, things that will shred a human being because they're trying to keep a file on, they're trying to, you know, swim over a canal or what have you. Yeah, throw the broomstick in the damn wheelchair, folks. He's an asshole.
Yeah, whoop, and he goes flying.
Because, you know, what, and in some respects, what that person who's trying to seek asylum is going through is far worse than him sitting, you know, being anchored in a wheelchair.
Yeah, and there's, you know, it's kind of like Sam looking at Rick and Casablanca and saying, you know, boss says he'll water his garden with his champagne before he lets the Nazis drink it. This champagne take the sting out of being occupied, won't it, boss? Well, you know, being a multimillionaire, and I'm not discounting, but being a multimillionaire probably takes a little bit of the sting out of Greg Aspott's life.
Because he does not have the same
struggle as a paraplegic living on SSI.
Or me, you know, I don't get the government. I mean, I'm getting help with the state to keep me working. And it's extremely expensive. You know, I mean, that's why my last boyfriend left me. I mean, you know, he said, I can't marry you because I can't afford your disability. I wasn't even asking. He just came.
That was an excuse.
Huh?
I said, that smells like an excuse. It's kind of like the cis guys who will date trans women and say, and let's say she hasn't disclosed. Well, let's say she hasn't disclosed, and she's, oh, by the way, I'm trans. And he goes, well, it's never going to work because I want kids.
Well, it was bullshit because basically.
Precisely my point.
You know, I was taking care of myself, and basically he was leaning on what he was really saying. He was the one that was not affordable. I couldn't afford him. I mean,
he was expensive. He was an expensive boyfriend. So it's like I was paying for everything. And that seemed to be, you know, how people are like, they more or less, they don't see the obvious, or they don't care to look at the obvious. I'm totally taking care of myself. I had my own home. I had everything. He didn't have any of those things. What he was really saying was, I can't afford you. What he really meant was he wanted someone who would just 100% take care of him.
And not just that, he was worried that as your disability progressed, you would be less able to carry his dead ass.
Exactly. And, you know, and it happened pretty quickly. But I think dealing with his bullshit, I think, expedited or sped up the progression. And I'm so glad he's out of my life. I'm so glad. Oh, my God. I can't begin to tell you. But
Man right out of my hair. Yeah, that.
Oh, Jesus. He was a leech. And so, I mean, I don't know. I guess with somebody like Greg Ascott, I would smack him upside the head. I don't know if I would necessarily see the need to throw a spoke in the wheelchair, but I mean, I would just, you know, I'm okay with hitting him. Even though he is in a wheelchair. There you go.
We're only speculating. Neither of us are anywhere near Texas Agent Fred, and we're only speculating, okay?
We're just speculating. You know, I wouldn't.
Wait. This may be the first time we've gotten to use the Joe Rogaine excuse. We're just asking questions.
Just asking questions, mm-hmm. man. Yeah, just asking questions.
Yeah.
And part of the reason I brought that up is there was a revelation out of the House of Representatives today. I mean, they're not in session or anything, but same. The majority leader in the House is Steve Scalise of Louisiana Stan.
Yeah, I caught a headline. Go ahead. Yep.
Yeah, you may recall that this is the guy who's so damn dim that he got shot up with semi-automatic weapons fire and remained doggedly devoted to the people who continue to write his checks at the NRA instead of having any empathy for anybody who's ever dealt with the same or similar circumstances. Well, Scalise said today,
after a few days of not feeling like myself this past week, does that mean he didn't feel like an asshole for a couple of days? I had some blood work done. The results uncovered some irregularities, and after undergoing additional tests, because I got some of the best health insurance in the entire world, y'all, I was diagnosed with multiple myeloma, a very treatable blood cancer. I'm incredibly grateful we were able to detect this early and that this cancer is treatable. I'm thankful for my excellent medical team that the taxpayers are paying for and I won't provide the same health care to. And with the help of God, support of my family, friends, colleagues, and constituents, I will tackle this with the same strength and energy as I've tackled past challenges, which is to say not tackling them at all.
Well, and you know, I would love ProPublica to do a quick story on how many times that son of a bitch voted against the ACA and voted to upend the ACA.
Yes, yes. Girl, testify.
You know, yeah, you throw that out there real quick, because I don't think he is of the same caliber as John McCain, you know, who at least had the capacity to, you know, some introspection when he had his, you know, the cancer that took his life, but he did the thumbs down there to Mitch McConnell. Because he realized, holy shit, I'm fortunate in that I have the medical care. I can't deny this to people who don't have it.
Right.
Or, you know, who need medical care in a situation. Like, at least, you know, he's one of the old school, you know, he was left before he died. Obviously, he's too liberal for the modern day ultra maggot Republican Party.
Yeah. And, you know, and you know, another thing worth bearing in mind,
is that Steve Scalise, being from Louisiana Stan, well, the fact of the matter is that Louisiana Stan is basically one entire state that's a giant cancer cluster.
Oh, God.
And, and in fact, they've got a there's a stretch of land that basically runs to, runs from Baton Rouge down to New Orleans, and I'm sure Jack in Shreveport could expand on this a little bit, but it's called Cancer Alley. It's no surprise to me that dude. Multiple myeloma. And he is, let's see. my God, he, oddly enough, he got, how quickly we forgot, he got mentioned a few days ago. He got, he when he entered the House of Representatives, he was following up on Piyush Jindal. No kidding. I'm trying to see, but you know, he was born in New Orleans, and I'm not the least bit surprised. Let me share a couple of emails real quick. Matt, a little bit ago, when I brought up the broom handle and the spokes, said, "You're giving me Betty Davis and Whatever Happened to Baby Jane." Matt, also, going back to Judge Chutkan, her court, maybe we can pool our money and give the judge a nice vacation to help her decide on the camera issue. Indonesia, Matt. And added on the letter about Fappy. Really? He was born a poor black child, and this is the route they chose? Yeah, I know.
They're just gross.
Signed, gross John Eastman. Signed, Epstein's mom. You might also get a kick. Well, not a kick. I mean, it's terrifying. But last week, I think it was, we had... We met for the first time, Georgia State Senator Colton Moore. Yeah, remember he's the guy that wants to. I've got a plan to immediately convene the Georgia legislature to stop this here process, and pardon him because he's dumber than a sack of hammer handles.
With Fanny.
Well, he went back on that rickety podcast platform run by the man who looks like rancid hot dog water smells. And he said, "Yo, I was talking to one of my fellow senators today. I said, when was the last time you spent $1 million on anything?" And apparently that was a reference to Senator Sean Still, who is one of the 18 minions with Nitwit Nero. I was like, "We got a fellow senator going to spend $1 million in defense of himself." But, and this is, I mean, they're going to go there. An actual Nazi shot up a Dollar General and killed 3 black people in Jacksonville, Florida, but... No. Senator Colton Moore, it's just like Nazi Germany. I mean, they want to call us the Nazis, and their actions are Nazism. I mean, first they go after your enemies, and you don't say anything because they're your enemies, and that's exactly where the governor is right now. He looks at Donald Trump as an enemy, so he's like, "I'm not going to say anything," right? Then they come after your friends. I got a friend who's being indicted. No, honey, he's not being indicted. He's been indicted. He's posted bail. Never mind. Many friends. Guess what? I'm seeing what they're doing to my enemies, and I'm trying to speak out for my friends, but my other senators are so reluctant. They're like, "Oh, no, I mean, I don't want to be charged for obstruction of justice if I move out here, say anything." Folks up in, the Stevie Three shirt says, the folks up in your district you represent, what are they telling you?" Oh, I mean, they couldn't be more excited about this fight that I pushed out. I can think of better ways of saying that. I mean, they don't want, they just sweat every day for those tax dollars. We're going somewhere here, Darlene, I promise. They see what's going on. They're scared for themselves. I mean, my goodness, how many people in my district question that election? I mean, and now we got 19 people facing the rest of their life in prison because they spoke out against the election. And he said, he was talking to another fellow senator. He said, they talked about taking action right now because if we don't, our constituencies are going to be fighting it in the streets. You want a civil war? I don't want a civil war. Last time we had a civil war, General Sherman came here and had a barbecue in the whole damn state. I don't want to have to draw my rifle. Get the Sharpie out and the copy paper and and maybe draw some swastikas on it while you're drawing it. I want to make this problem go away with my legislative means of doing so, and the first step to getting that done is defunding Fannie Willis of any Georgia tax dollars. They can't resist the eliminationist reference to the firearms, can they, right, Darlene?
Yeah. They're so ignorant. They're just so ignorant. I'm so sick of the stupidity. You know, but I guess I don't even know where to begin with that. You know, Bannon is a piece of shit. Why is he still free?
Because Maggot Judge.
You know, and it's like, yeah, because of Maggot Judge. You brought up the tragedy in Jacksonville. I couldn't listen. I was unable to listen to your program yesterday because I have my obligations with my local business circle group. I'm the secretary, you know, writer. Everybody wants to be the secretary of this, that, and the other thing. I did see a clip of DeSantis and the brains behind his failing operation, his wife there. They were at the mic, and people were booing him there in Jacksonville. And I believe it was it the mayor, who was an African American woman, that scolded the crowd. She had the thick white framed glasses, and how she said, "You know, I for one, I'm sick of what's happening. He's coming here, giving us, you know, helping us out, giving us much needed." Money.
Oh, yeah, is this the bullets don't have politics woman? I think Didn't she say that?
She may have said that. I mean, I feel for her. She's walking a really tough. I mean, she's in a tough situation. Because you know, Jacksonville is the largest metropolis. I mean, it's the largest city in the southeastern United States. Charlotte is second, and I have some empathy for her because, you know, it's a city that has problems, just like Charlotte does, you know, because I started writing for my client in Charlotte, my first out-of-state client. So I'm learning a lot about Charlotte. This is an incredible city. It's like the sixth fastest growing city in the United States. It's the second largest, most populous city behind Jacksonville. And there are real problems in these cities. Charlotte also has a black, an African-American mayor. And so the mayor in Jacksonville, you know, he's probably thinking whatever he's, you know, he's a piece of shit.
you know, it's awful because I cannot blame the people for doing it because he's a racist bigot, you know, trying to erase African-American history, everything. And I don't understand why he even showed his ugly mug there and is trying to help, but I can totally empathize with this mayor taking what she can get to help people in the city. So it is squeamish. It's not, you know, it's a tough one. And so I just wanted to throw that out there. I take it that you seem to be of the mindset that she should have basically told him to go pound sand.
No, not so much. I may be wrong about who said what, but there was an individual who said bullets don't have politics. And that just made me eat dirt and run rabbits.
I think she did say that. No, I think she did say that. Now that I'm thinking back on what she said, the bullets don't know. Yeah, whether you're a Republican or Democrat or whatever. But like, you know, I'm no expert. I'm learning. The work that this group is doing that I'm writing for is amazing work, and I mean the level of grants that they go for is massive. I mean, they wouldn't waste their time with a measly $5,000 grant. I mean, they're like, they don't even like applying for anything less than $25,000. That's a low end grant for them. And so I'm learning. I mean, I'm learning about one part of the city. That is a historic African-American neighborhood, and the rich history, and it's got a historically black college and university that's an anchor institution
right
in the neighborhood. And, you know, it's their work is mostly focused in that area, although they do stuff citywide as well. And they have a good mayor. You know, she's a good mayor. She's trying to lift the neighborhood and the city in general, and there's just so many freaking problems. I mean, the affordable housing problem in that county is just massive. And these are real problems, you know, so considering that it's second largest in Jacksonville is the largest. I don't know if I can fault this mayor. She probably needs help and is grabbing whatever she can get from this asshole governor. It's just an awful position to be in. So I have empathy for her just based on, you know, just what I'm seeing. And from what I'm learning about Charlotte, and it's an incredible education for me, and just the incredible dedication and work that I'm seeing from this this client that is all African American staff. I mean, again, I I laugh because I think, you know, white girl from Connecticut, yeah, as Tracy says, as a consultant. And sadly, the director got COVID, and she's been really struggling. I'm actually quite concerned, and it's a really, it's a tough situation because I'm only starting to get to know these individuals, and as a white person, I'm trying to not overstep boundaries. I'm trying to, you know, and they're wonderful individuals. So I don't feel comfortable asking questions like that. I wouldn't think twice about asking, you know, close friends or people that are white. So it's really, you know, raising some interesting things for me to contemplate, you know, as to whether or not she got the vaccine. You know, I don't know if I can go there, you know, because I'm actually quite concerned because she really got hit hard, and we know that people of African American backgrounds got hit hard by COVID. I'm curious as to whether or not it's a new variant
you know, I'm wondering. I have a lot of questions, but I don't feel it is appropriate for me to ask. It's, you know, I don't know. I don't feel I know them well enough to ask that question. But it's hard for her because she's high energy, highly dedicated and high energy individual who, you know, she's so dedicated, and it's in honor of her father and what he has done for the community, that it's been a real struggle for her, I think, not to be able to be out there doing what she needs to do as a director of this agency in that city. So there are very real problems in these major cities. I guess I'm getting off on that tangent, but I feel for this mayor in Jacksonville.
I do too, and the history is so brutal.
They're complex.
There was something. Yeah. There's an event in Jacksonville's history called something like Axe Handle Saturday, in which. White people got axe handles and just went out and beat the living hell out of black people for the hell of it. So, you know, those traumas roll through communities, and they terminate and stay resident in the operating system. And I was talking about Justin Jones earlier, Darlene. You know, they're in Tennistan. That young man is fire. And part of the reason they shut him down today was because of what he said about white supremacy. And he did so under the rubric of honoring the 60th anniversary of the March on Washington for jobs and freedom. And that was commemorated this past weekend. He gets way deep under the skin of the old South white folks there in the Tennessee legislature. I got the clip.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Today I want to honor the 60th anniversary. August 28th is the 60th anniversary of the March on Washington, where thousands. Hundreds of thousands of Americans gathered in Washington to challenge systemic racism and economic exploitation. I would like to read some of the words of Congressman John Lewis, who was the youngest speaker at that march. He stated there, the time will come when we will not confine our marching to Washington. We will march through the South, through the heart of Dixie, the way Sherman did. We shall pursue our own scorched earth policy and burn Jim Crow to the ground nonviolently. We shall fragment the South into 1,000 pieces and put them back together in the image of democracy. We'll make the action of the past few months look petty. And I say to you, wake up, America. I think those words which Representative Lewis planned to say when he was a young man but were censored in his speech because some people were uncomfortable with them speak to the moment that we're in. Because the truth be told, white supremacy is not a mental health issue. It is about terrorism. And the shooting that happened in Jacksonville, Florida, was not, quote unquote, racially motivated. It was racial terrorism. And until we acknowledge that fact, until we act on that fact, it will continue to happen. Jacksonville, Florida, Buffalo, New York, Charleston, South Carolina. How many acts of racial terror will it take for us to see that there is an issue, a crisis, an emergency of white supremacy in this nation? That is the gravest threat that we face as a multiracial democracy. And so while those members want to honor mental health, there's people who we can't honor today. Their names are Angela Michelle Carr, age 52, killed in Jacksonville, Florida, by a white supremacist who wrote a swastika on his AR-15. Their names are Noel Joseph A.J. Lagour Jr., age 29, who was terrorized and murdered and killed by a man who wrote a swastika on his AR-15. Their names are Jarrell Deshaun Gallion, 19, who we can't honor
because a white supremacist wrote a swastika on our AR-15 and went into a Dollar General and took his life because of racial hatred. Let's be honest about what this is about. This is not mental health. Perhaps the mental health issue is doing nothing when you see tragedy happening. Perhaps the mental health issue is refusing to change the way you act and expecting different results. That is insanity. And so the way we honor them, I'm not going to call for a moment of silence because we've had too much silence in this body. I'm going to call for a moment of action. Let's protect these black lives. Let's protect the lives of nine-year-olds. Let's protect the lives of our people instead of making excuses and deflecting on other issues. Because if you are sane enough to know that you want to put a swastika on your gun and write a whole manifesto and punctuate your racial hatred, then we know it's not about mental health. But it's about a deeper sickness in America, a deeper moral malady, a deeper illness that is bone deep in this nation. It's the same hatred that led to Tennesseans being lynched in many of our counties. It's the same hatred that led black people to build this Capitol without pay and be abused and mistreated. It's the same hatred that many of us want to ban from being taught. And so it is just so frustrating to see members not even honor those who died, not even respect black death enough to call it out for what it is and want to distract us and say thank you when all we're saying is we want our people to live and that black lives should matter more than this blind obedience to weapons of war terrorizing our community. And so on this march on Washington, I hope that that march comes to Tennessee. I hope that that march comes to Nashville. And I hope that it unsettles us enough to do something, to act as a voice of conscience in this time, to challenge the hatred of white supremacy, the white supremacist terrorism that has been so definitive and that was present at our Capitol last Monday when the Proud Boys were outside of this building. It's the same strand of white supremacy that we must challenge. We have an obligation to do better for all future generations.
Representative Capley.
Damn. Right?
Yeah. I'm speechless. I'm speechless. To say anything would be, I just would pale. I'm speechless.
And meanwhile,
yeah,
not that, no, straight down, meanwhile, straight down I-65 from Nashville, Tennessee, in Montgomery, Alabama, the cops today were investigating a majority black neighborhood in Montgomery called Danley Pines. The call came in about 6:30 on Saturday about vandalism. And when the cops showed up, they found swastikas spray painted all over cars and houses in the Danley Pines neighborhood. And, well, yeah, the windows were broken. There were, that word had been spray painted.
And rhymes with rigor.
Yeah, yes, yes. Riggers.
Which isn't even a word.
And of course.
He's a piece of shit.
Yeah. And of course, as is often the case with these news reports, no arrests have been made. And this is always my favorite part. Now, remember, this is swastikas spray painted all over a majority black neighborhood, spray painted on cars, spray painted on houses. That word, broken windows, and no motive has been determined.
And people who are African American, black people in this country, epitomize the idea and the concept of patience. It's ridiculous for me to even say it. But I think there was a woman. I don't know who she was, but it was during the Black Lives Matter marches, and there was some violence, and I think it was the aftermath of George Floyd. and his murder before, you know, before our very eyes. And she was angry, and she said, you know, she said something along the lines of, you know, you're lucky that we're not burning it down. We should be burning it all down.
Oh, I loved it. And I was familiar with those.
You know?
Those,
and she's,
yeah, I was familiar with those censored words of John Lewis that he wanted to say 60 years ago. But, yeah, what power? You can't talk about sending Sherman across the South again. That'll get them real upset. We don't want to, I mean, we want rights and stuff, but we don't want to say the S word to the white people now. But it's true. It's absolutely true.
Well, the two Justins are, you know, they're rising superstars in the political firmament. Sounds very cliched, but they are. The other Justin, I don't know what he speaks. I don't know. To me, he reminds me, or seems in my ignorance, I would say. But he conjures in my view, Malcolm X. I don't know. I just the way his inflections and the way he, like, the oration is amazing. Both of the Justins, they just, the way that they put things, and just they captivate. And I am grateful that they were reinstated pretty damn quickly. That says something. It gives a sense of hope, I guess. But really, the survival of this aspirational democracy, I think, really rests on individuals such as them. I don't know if you agree, but
I do.
That's kind of how I
mean, I would love nothing more than to see Justin Jones replaced Marsha Blackburn in the Senate of the United States.
Oh, that awful, disgusting, vile. She is a disgusting, and vile human being.
And that's the thing. These maggots are fools standing at the shoreline, commanding the tide not to come in. Tide's coming. Speaking of which, I had a note from Scary Jerry earlier. Who is Idalia sends her warmest regards. Most of our Scary Jerry said most of our weather stations are offline. Wish we cared about weather instrumentation as much as we did deporting immigrants who ain't ours. The storm is beelining to Tallahassee, the governor's mansion. It's cooking about 120 miles an hour. 5 o'clock update said 100, but that's a reading from 2 hours ago. They have to fly a plane into it. How 1950s of them, did Jerry's right? Feels like 120, source, 30 hurricane survivor. The weather's breezy, sultry, and emotional. I love canes. Watching the back of them head somewhere else. Well, yeah, it's nice when you're not the one who has to, you know, put plywood on any windows or anything.
Well, Franklin is a real bastard. He's out in the Atlantic. He's like a cat five. He's a major one and is going to brush Bermuda. So they're gonna have some major swells, but Franklin, he is a big one too. I think even bigger than Idalia. I don't understand how they do the naming, you know, Pacific versus, I don't know why they came up with Hillary. California. We've been lucky here. We have been the general consensus is we've had a shitty summer. It's been cold, you know, more on the cool side and rainy, but we've been blessed. The heat dome never reached us.
Yeah, we've been largely untouched, knock wood. I mean, I guess next week we're going to see some 90s.
Yep, with the hurricanes, yes. I think the seasons are messed up. So, yeah, so like it's like a delayed summer into September, which I'm like totally cool with. Because like you, and I know you conjure me around. Oh, really? You know, yeah, yes, yes. It is, the leaves are turning here in Connecticut.
You know, it was just last week last week that Starbucks initiated pumpkin spice season. I get mad every year. The thing, you know, at least it's something I can get mad at and not get too worked up. Oh my God! I just saw a picture of Franklin.
He's a big bad boy out there, and we're lucky because it's missing us. Now, I don't know if we're going to remain lucky because we're due here, at least here in Connecticut. We're due. Here, it's a gorgeous evening. It's an absolutely gorgeous evening. I saw something very sweet over the weekend. Because we have a very healthy bear population, black bear population here in my town. They're lazy ass bears. I mean, they're really huge. And they're like,
The bears are scrounging?
Yeah. Well, they're dumpster divers, and they're just, you know, and a lot of people around here don't realize, like, do not want to put bird feeders out. And I used to be a big bird feeder type person throughout the year. Like, if I, you know, winter, summer, whatever, until a black bear came up the fire escape of my apartment and was looking into my living room with a flimsy screen and proceeded to consume the black oil sunflower seed out of my hopper mere feet away from my flimsy screen of my slider. And I said, okay, that's it. We're not doing this anymore. I really don't put bird feeders out, but I do put a hummingbird feeder out. I usually wait until like June. I actually was pretty late this year, mid-July. And it's kind of tucked in the corner, sort of hidden, and it's a heavy glass feeder. So it, you know, so far so good in terms of a bear getting to it. I didn't just jinx myself. But last year, the hummingbirds hung around till mid-September or later. And usually they start flying south, you know, at the end of August. But over the weekend, I saw, you know, hummingbirds are very territorial. The hummingbirds around here, I mean, I've seen them going after other birds that are like 1.5 to 10 times their size. It was hilarious because I had the broad-winged hawk sitting on the branch of one of the dead trees here in my backyard, way in the back. There's a dead ash tree from the boreal ash insect. It's been killing off the ash trees. And this hummingbird was freaking dive-bombing the hawk. And the hawk wasn't bothering it. You know, it was not hungry, so it's not going to go attacking. It doesn't... Raptors do not kill indiscriminately. They only kill if they need food. Otherwise, they're not going to just attack a bird or kill for sport, which is an amazing thing about a raptor. So I saw two hummingbirds kind of, you know, going like, I thought they were sparring. But what it was a mama feeding her baby. And I have daylilies that bloom in July, and they're still blooming. And we're into late August. We're into the last week of August. So everything is delayed in terms of things. But Mama was, you know, taking the nectar from the daylily and feeding it to the baby.
Oh!
And I have...
I'm sorry, I'm going to get all...
Oh my God, and then the baby began to feed itself. Mama disappeared. She flew to the apple tree next to the daylilies. And the baby, and you know, the baby was not adept at it yet. It was kind of almost like trying to, like, to maintain its balance. And it was kind of clinging to the daylily petal and began feeding for itself. from the Daylily. And I got to witness a whole new world opening up to this baby hummingbird. And I have a good pair of binoculars.
So I'm just melting in the chair. I'm just destroyed.
Isn't that the sweetest? That is the sweetest freaking thing. So the baby started feeding for itself from the Daylily, and guaranteed, the baby already learned how to feed from my feeder, which has perches and everything else. But these birds are so brilliant. They're so clever, birds in general, that they still, you know, they're not relying solely on the sugar water that I put in the feeder, but they're still going, you know, to the daylilies, to the tumbleweed or touch me nots. I have a slew of them. There's like a 20-foot hedge of jewelweed. It's called jewelweed or touch me nots. And, so they make sure that they have a variety, that they get it from the real stuff and from the sugar water that I feed them in the feeder. And it was just the sweetest thing. And I didn't realize it, but the day before I witnessed that, I had the mama near me. She came up to me, and I heard another. Hummingbird nearby, but I didn't want to move. I was like, she was like hovering near me with the baby. And I like to think she was introducing me to the baby, because they know it's amazing, because they know that I'm the source of the sugar water. Because when the feeder gets low, they're like coming at me. They're like, where's our food? It's amazing. They're just so intelligent.
And that so noise.
Oh, yeah. Yes. And the brr, you know, when they're very, like I said, they're very territorial. And they just, they'll go after other birds. And it seems like they're sparring with each other. But I got to witness something that I've never seen before, is a mama basically, you know, teaching its little one how to take nectar from the flowers. So that was like the coolest thing. That was so cool. I had to share that.
I'm glad you did. I like to close the program with a little something happy. And sometimes, you know, because I had my happy story ready to go. Young Herr Kyle Rattenhouse. Well,
him.
Yeah, he got to stay out of the joint, but now he's reached the he's reached the O.J. Simpson civil trial part of the process. And so he's being sued along with the Kenosha Police Department, who were grossly negligent. But young Kyle Rattenhouse, who was bragging, took a selfie of himself in front of the United States Capitol and said, "Well, this is going to be my home someday." Yeah, fuck off, you killer. Well, he's getting sued within an inch of his life. And
well,
he gave
him,
yeah, and he's he doesn't like it, because he's special. He's Kyle Rattenhouse, and he's a patriot. Just ask the Proud Boys. So being covered up in lawsuits, and yeah, the facts are just obscene, but we won't delve into that. This is the pull quote. He gave an interview to some right-wing gas bag blog and said, "These lawsuits are making it harder and harder for me to move on with my life. It's extremely difficult. It's extremely difficult to go outside without fear of being harassed or assaulted because of the lies spread in these lawsuits. No one should have to continue to defend the fact that they acted in self-defense." There's no lies in the lawsuit. He killed people. Yep. He was allowed to run amok by law enforcement in Kenosha. Law enforcement only applied the curfew that was in place to people who were protesting police violence, but young Kyle Rottenhouse got to run around the streets until he found somebody that he could claim he murdered justifiably. And see, another of his victims, Daddy, is suing him, and a federal court is letting that lawsuit go forward. The estate of estate of what's his first name? Joseph Rosenbaum is suing him, and the estate of Anthony Huber is suing him. Because he murdered, he killed those people. He killed him. He killed him.
Right. Straight, yeah. He killed people. You know, does he not realize that? You know, really, you killed people. You could sit there and, you know, justify whatever. You took human life. You know, it's like there's something wrong with him. But this is what you had hoped for. So, you know, that he would be dogged for the rest of his life and not be able to put away 1 cent without somebody suing his sorry little ass.
So, but you did. You touched people with your hummingbird story.
That's good.
Cynthia in the Bay Area just sent a photo in. A leucistic hummingbird in my backyard 8 years ago. Speaking of hummingbirds, how about this little beauty that I photographed 8 years ago in my backyard? A real angelic beauty. Oh, yes.
Oh, they are.
You know, wings swept forward, leaning in to get the nectar out of the flower. Oh.
And you know, here, sadly, I don't know if you find this in West Virginia, but we only have one species of hummingbird that come up this far. That's the ruby throat.
Yeah, they're the most ubiquitous ones.
But we don't get, I mean, you know, the further south, you know, you have some amazing, amazing species of hummingbird. But I am anticipating that the hummingbirds here are probably going to hang in. Seems the weather's going to be fairly warm. Into at least mid-September, I think they're probably going to hang in at least a couple of more weeks, which will be nice. And when they go, I feel so sad because it does, you know, signify the end of, you know, the season that you and I love so much.
Yes.
Yeah. But,
well, strap in, all get right, your pumpkin spice, and just deal with it. We
pumpkin spice. I mean, the only good soup. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, I think I'm gonna start a protest. I'm calling it apple pie spice henceforward. They're the same spices. You know, I object to being manipulated by Big Pumpkin. That's what it is, Darlene.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean...
Well, hell, I'm giving myself a cowbell for Big Pumpkin. Hold on.
The big pumpkin?
No, not the big pumpkin. You know, big pumpkin, like big oil, big coal.
Oh, right. Big pumpkin, yeah. Well, it gets really bad here because the grocery stores in August start selling Halloween candy.
Oh, I had a note. I had a note from Randy Radar a little bit ago. He said the Vermont Country Store was advertising for Christmas. I unsubscribed. Good for you. Fight the man, Randy.
There you go.
By the way, David in South Carolina stand says Idalia is going to visit Myrtle. Hopefully, it'll just brush by. I hope it brushes by on the right side. Because, you know, which side of the hurricane you're on matters.
Yeah.
But it's been a lovely conversation. We've been all over the place. Thank you for that.
Yes, thank you. I mean, I wanted to also touch, we can do this another time, but I wanted to touch on the whole thing with, you know, the right wing and all of that stuff with Trump being ineligible to run. I find it fascinating that they're all coming out with this now, including Luttig, and I think they know, I think they know that Trump can't win. Let's hope. I mean, it's a terrible gamble to have to take, but I'd rather have Trump up against Joe Biden so Joe Biden can beat him like a drum a second time.
Yes.
I'm also wondering, you know, what that means, because people are starting to sue and say, you know, the secretaries of state should get Trump off the ballot. But I wonder what that means for the likes of a Marjorie Trader Gangrene, Josh Hawley, et cetera. So for another time, yeah. I got to get in.
I think that's a good conversation. Let me tell you one thing. Yeah. Jude sent us a note. Bless Darlene's heart and her hummingbirds let you know, dear heart, I hope I make sense to you two. I felt led to call you both and comforted in doing so. It was on the stress line. But, of course, you're on the stress line, so I couldn't do anything about it. I wanted to offer, it's all about timing. This woman here is currently experiencing irritability, so processing has been raw with all that's swirling around. Mm-hmm. It's the ongoing reminder of refining oneself to the fullest of our being, the journey of alchemy. And yes, Robin, Rumi. I like this. When everything around you seems dark, look again. You may be the light. What light those hummingbirds manifested to Darlene that shifted energy to a higher, more sensitive place. Good. Good. That's kind of
Isn't
the purpose
that lovely?
Here. Yes, it is. That's kind of the purpose here.
So true.
Well, yep. Darlene, have a lovely evening.
You too. Thank
cherish,
you, my friend.
Let's see. Cherish these 24 days.
Yeah. Until autumn sets in. Yes, we're you know, meteorological summer is ending this week.
Cultural summer ends with Labor Day. That's when they shut down the pools if there are still pools.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. So, last hurrah, I guess.
Yeah, enjoy those warm days we've got left. They're coming.
I got to get out. And I mean, my freckles have been entirely neglected all summer long.
There you go.
It's just wrong. I got maybe one last chance at a decent freckling. So, and by the way, just in terms of nature and stuff, during the entire 3 hours of this program, Darlene, I watched a tiny cricket. Who has been perched on my ring light there by the monitor and has just crawled around a little bit. Maybe she's enjoying the warmth. But I'm guessing baby cricket or maybe a very tiny species. I don't know. But she hasn't made any noise. She's been a total lady. Mm-hmm. And just every now and then wiggles her antennae at me. And that's just, I like crickets. Wrote a poem about a cricket once.
Crickets are the coolest things.
Yeah, they are. And they're just, and aw, she's grooming. How sweet. Oh, well. Or maybe she's eating something that no one else can see that's on the ring light. I don't know. But she's adorable. And I hope nothing gets her.
Same here.
Hi,
bye,
darling.
Have
a good
night. Evening.
See ya. Bye. And so that's the program. God, the end of the month is hard. So let's see. 1940. Tomorrow will be 2240. It's tough. Oh, by the way, Brother Deacon Asa adds, wait, Darlene, those are black bears. It's technically called looting, not foraging. Asa said, I know, the murder hornets can take a number. Add a little food porn to end things up. Brother Deacon Asa said, I tried Todd's trick. I marinated these lamb chops in Italian dressing overnight. Ooh, those are going to grill up so nice. There must be food porn photos, you know, after you have completed them, Brother Deacon. So thanks, everybody. Thanks to our Patreon and PayPal subscribers. Thanks to our a la carte contributors. Thank you to our each and every one of you who share your precious finite time engaging in the program in whatever manner you so choose. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you, Roger, in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, HeadOn.live. Listen, it really matters when you like and subscribe to the podcast. It encourages others to maybe give it a listen for the first time, too. And it's always fun to hear from first-time listeners who go, wow, I had no idea there was anything like this out there. And there is. Leave a comment for the algorithms. Tell your friends and neighbors. Share it. You know, if you download it, put it on social media. Share it. Let's build the conversation. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. 20 plus years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice, and a proud union shop. Please stay safe. I guess there's another booster coming in the offing sometime in September. In the meantime, wear your mask especially when you're around the maggots, because they don't give a damn about anybody but themselves, and they don't think much of themselves, for that matter. That's why they're maggots. Wash your hands, don't touch your face, use your hand sanitizer, carry some with you, pocket or purse, maintain your social distance, and, if a sniveling little pseudo-adolescent comes towards you with an AR-15 whining about how he can't go out no more, avoid young Kyle Rottenhouse like the plague, because he is. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later.